case under advisement to our final case of the day, U.S. versus James Carroll, 13-2600. Ms. Varner. There goes our audience.
Yeah. That's okay with me. Good morning. May it please the court. Probable cause cannot be supported by unreasonably stale information. Probable cause must be shown to exist at the time of the search and not simply at some remote point in the past. Probable cause is a fluid concept. An assessment of probable cause requires a close look at probabilities in a particular factual context. And in this factual context, we're talking about child pornography. Based on the guidance from this court, we know several things. We know that the probable cause analysis looks different in a case involving child pornography by Prideaux-Wentz. We know that there's an assessment that child pornographers are more likely to collect these items and keep them for longer, so that a longer period of time may be supported. We know that from the Siever case that particularly in cases where computers are involved, that probable cause may be supported for an even greater period of time because of the nature of computers, that computer files are kept for a longer period of time, and there's a great potential for latent discovery of these items. However, the set of facts before this court is very unique. What the government is asking for in this case is unprecedented. The government was not able to point to a case, nor was I able to find a case, where 5 years was upheld as sufficient to support probable cause. In addition, we're looking at a case where the affidavit in support of the search warrant consisted of a mere 3 pages. This is very different than affidavits that have been looked at in other cases, such as in Prideaux-Wentz, where the affidavit was, I believe it was 40 pages and 66 paragraphs long. Additionally, we have a unique set of circumstances because in this particular case, in the affidavit supporting the search warrant, there was no use of a computer actually alleged at the time of the crime. Finally, there was no evidence to refresh. In this particular case, the facts and circumstances happened 5 years prior. There was no...
Going back to this computer point... Isn't it true that in the affidavit, Detective Spivey advised the judge that the girl noted that the defendant had a digital camera?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? Wouldn't it be a fair inference that somebody who's using a digital camera would also have a computer to augment the use of the camera, especially a person who's so involved in photography?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but I point out that fact to show, one, that Siever, we don't think it's necessary that this court actually reach Siever, but we do agree that reasonable inferences are allowable, but just to point out that that was an inferential leap that had to be made. There wasn't an allegation in other court cases that this court has looked at where there's a username ascribed to a user, where there's tips that they're uploading and downloading videos, where there's evidence that they are actually in using a computer to possess, distribute these items.
The information here is that the target of the investigation was a professional photographer and was the producer of the images in question, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And given the affidavit's more general information about collectors, why isn't the fact that this fellow was both a producer and a professional photographer, according to the information, pretty powerful indication that he's likely to have saved the images?
Well, I don't know that I would agree that there, just because he was a professional photographer, that he had a greater likelihood of saving images than anyone else. In fact, being a professional photographer, perhaps he might have had and using a camera in conjunction with his work, he might have had a stronger motivation not to transfer those images to a computer and to simply view them from a digital camera. I do agree that there's an inference, an easy inferential leap there, but it's not one that has to be made in this case, and I don't think this court has to reach the Siever analysis. If the court does reach the Siever analysis.
I don't want to leave this point yet. I think it's important to realize that child pornography images of anonymous children can be easily replaced with child pornography images of other anonymous children. But in this case, we have evidence that the defendant himself took the picture. And this was a picture of a girl who he had personally abused. Well, wouldn't it be a fair inference that that would be irreplaceable and you just couldn't swap that out for another anonymous image of an anonymous child? This had a very special significance to the defendant, and therefore it's a fair inference that he wouldn't want to get rid of this, that he would keep it, that he would treasure it.
I think what Your Honor is getting at is more just the nature of collectors of child pornography themselves, that those images, and particularly maybe ones that they took themselves, are more special to them. But there wasn't evidence that he actually took the photo in the affidavit. There were a number of pieces of information of what happened at the actual time laid out in the affidavit, and that was that a 13-year-old girl reported that 5 years previous she was molested on at least one occasion by Mr. Carroll, that she was shown photos on a digital camera that she, I believe, referred to as Victoria's Secret-type photos of other children, and that there was a possibility, albeit a strong possibility, that he had also taken photos of her, but there was no direct evidence of that in the actual affidavit.
But what she said, she described an incident believed to involve Mr. Carroll. She did not see the camera, but explained hearing the camera operate and indicated she was knowledgeable of the camera's operation. She believed it to be the camera of Mr. Carroll.
Correct. She believed it to be him.
Right. Well, isn't that evidence that Mr. Carroll actually did take an image of her?
I would say it's evidence, but it also requires a leap. It requires a belief in these facts at the time. If the court does decide that the Siever analysis has to be reached in this case, I think that Siever was this court's way of saying that there is something special about computer files, that they may be replaced, but very slowly. And in this case, there's enough that there also has to be, I don't think that the end run of that, this court didn't say, time is never a factor in these cases. And as we argued in our brief, I think there has to be parity between the strength of the evidence at the time of the offense and how long probable cause can possibly be supported on that evidence. And in this case, the strength of the evidence was low in 2012. As I stated, there were inferences that were necessary to get to the computer.
The issuing judge weighs that, doesn't the issuing magistrate judge weigh that?
Correct.
We don't re-weigh that.
This court does take a fresh look at whether probable cause was supported by the affidavit in question.
And not de novo, is it?
I believe that since what happened factually is not an issue in this case, that this court does look de novo at whether probable cause is supported.
Not sure. I think it's deferential.
Ms. Varner, let me ask. If I understood you correctly in your brief, you acknowledge that probable cause existed at the time. If the girl had come forward with the same information, let's say the day after the encounter with Mr. Carroll, right?
I believe that's probably the case, Your Honor.
Okay. I got to ask you. So when did probable cause dissipate here?
That's a very difficult question, and I think that's the question that this court has to answer.
How do we write an opinion that doesn't sound foolish or arbitrary?
I believe in this case that this court can say there has to be parity or a parallel relationship between strength of the evidence and the period of time, and that in this case, where there was a very short affidavit, wasn't extremely long and detailed as far as the investigation that was in Prideaux Wins, where inferences were necessary to get to there even being a computer present, then there was no evidence also to refresh. I think that's a very important factor. There was no ongoing investigation. There were no tips. There was no allegation that he was using an email address or a user ID to upload or download pornography. That in that particular case, yes, Siever indicated that it could be a very long time in a case where a computer is present, but this is not the case that I believe it supports a very long period of time. And I see that I've entered my time for rebuttal, so if there's no further questions, I'll reserve.
All right. Mr. Myers?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Zachary Myers here on behalf of the United States of America, and I was counsel below. But before I get into my presentation, I did want to answer one of the questions about the legal standard that I believe the Court asked. The sufficiency of the affidavit in support of the warrant is, in fact, reviewed de novo. However, probable cause should be evaluated based on the totality of the circumstances, and special deference should, in fact, be afforded to the judges or to the decision of the judge issuing the warrant. And in this case, this was a state court child molestation investigation where the detective prepared a three-page, single-spaced affidavit that provided more than enough information for the state court judge to find that, in fact, probable cause existed to believe that evidence with regards to the crimes listed in that affidavit, child molestation and possession of child pornography, would be found. I think that the key information provided in the affidavit that supports the belief of the detective, which was found to be sufficient by the state court and which is afforded special deference in this court, is, yes, Girl One reported that 5 years previously Mr. Carroll had touched her on her genitalia underneath her clothing, had shown her, using a digital camera, images of children younger than her, posed professionally in Victoria's Secret-style photos, and importantly, that information, in terms of his usage, and also that a man that she believed to be Mr. Carroll, and there are two men in the house, and it wasn't her and she says it wasn't her father, she knows Mr. Carroll's camera because of her familiarity with him, and familiarity with the camera, including that he used it to show her child pornography or child erotica, and that individual lifted up her clothing while she was pretending to be asleep and took a photograph of her bare genitalia. And I think that information coupled with, in fact, refreshed information from from Girl One's father, that he was a co-worker of Mr. Carroll, that he knew Mr. Carroll to be a professional photographer, that Mr. Carroll, as of the time of the warrant...
At the time of the affidavit or at the time the
at the time of the affidavit. The information from Girl One's father was current as of the time of the affidavit.
Well, the defendant was a professional photographer at the time of the affidavit. Was
yes.
He a professional photographer at the time of the acts?
Yes.
How do we know?
I don't know how clearly it is spelled out either in the stipulated factual basis or you would find it in the pre-sentence investigation report in this case. But Mr. Carroll was, in fact, the best friend of Girl One's father, and for all the period of time relevant to this case, he was
but
a professional photographer.
What's in the pre-sentence report wouldn't have been before the magistrate that took the affidavit for the search.
I see where you're going, Your Honor. And if you turn, let me turn briefly to the affidavit itself, where, and I won't use the girl's name or father's name here, obviously, but Girl One's father, according to the affidavit presented to the magistrate judge, advised that he does work present tense with Mr. Carroll, and that Mr. Carroll is a professional photographer. And in fact, one of the warrants that you see presented in addition to the warrant.
That's my point. There was no evidence before the magistrate judge that says Mr. Carroll was a professional photographer at the time that the acts were performed.
Let me go back to the information from... Yes, there was, actually. If you look in the information in the affidavit, and this is about in the middle of page 3 of the affidavit, which is docket 46, the information from Girl 1, which is about the molestation of her, she states that the last sentence there of that paragraph, that she knew him to be an avid/professional photographer and had spent time around him and his camera. So I think that when you couple the past information from Girl 1 with the present information from her father, because as she stated, her involvement with him in terms of the camera and the molestation ended 5 years previously. I think that refreshes the fact that he is still a professional photographer. He is, as the father said, still carrying a digital camera every day, carrying various digital storage media every day, and as Detective Spivey states in his affidavit, with computer technology, with a push of a button, information can be moved and digital images can be moved from a camera to a computer to any sort of device. In fact, the images here were found on multiple locations, both on Mr. Carroll's computer and on external DVDs that he had saved the images on. And that's established in the information, in the charging information, which sets forth where specifically each image was found.
Mr. Myers, can we affirm without overruling Prideaux-Wentz?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you can. I don't think that Prideaux-Wentz was necessarily directly overturned by Siever. I think that some of the analysis about, or some of The focus on collector behavior.
There's different analysis.
Yes.
But we've got 7 months in Seaver. We've got 4 years in Prideaux-Wentz.
I think that Prideaux-Wentz can be clearly distinguished from the present case without this court needing to overturn it in order to find that probable cause was established by this affidavit on several bases. First, the identification in Prideaux-Wentz was about there was a NCMEC report of a unique online user that had been associated with uploading and downloading child pornography through Yahoo groups. Here, in Mr. Carroll's case, Girl One said that this man who I know and who my father knows molested me. So the strength of the identification, because the officer in Prideaux-Wentz used subpoena information to determine what individual should be held responsible for that user account, made more complicated by the fact that Mr. Prideaux-Wentz actually moved residences during the time period of the investigation. And I think critically, the timing of the crime, while it's true that it was 5 years between the allegation of molestation by Girl One and the presentation of the affidavit, the timing of the crime in Prideaux-Wentz was unknown, a fact that was, I think, directly criticized by the court in Prideaux-Wentz, because since the government in that case and the investigators in that case didn't use subpoenas to obtain information from Yahoo about when these things happened, there was no specific information as to when the child pornography was uploaded, only when the report was received by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And I think it's also critical to distinguish, as the court did in focusing on the value of the information to a producer versus a collector, that Prideaux-Wentz was a child pornography trafficking case as opposed to here a molestation case involving taking of images. And I think also very importantly, the defendant in Prideaux-Wentz sought a Franks hearing seeking to challenge the reliability of the information set forth in the affidavit and claiming that the information about the officer's knowledge of computers and digital forensics and all those things was misleading. Here, at every stage of these proceedings, there's been no challenge by Mr. Carroll to anything in the affidavit, and therefore we're restricted to the information presented by Detective Spivey to the Marion Superior Court to determine if probable cause existed at that time.
If those grounds for distinguishing Prideaux-Wentz are accurate, then maybe you're getting to one of my concerns here, which is what happens if the next case we've simply got an affidavit that says we've got evidence that 5 years ago a computer associated with the defendant received child pornography. Would that still be fresh enough to go in and do a search?
I think that, you know, as the court repeatedly says, probable cause is a very fact-specific analysis. But aside from, I mean, without knowing more about what's in that affidavit, if that affidavit couples the information about receipt of child pornography with information presented to the magistrate that, in fact, individuals who receive child pornography have this motivation to keep it for a long time,
we've got that in this affidavit.
We do have that in this affidavit. But I think also, critically, not just the collector behavior, but the information relied on in Seaver, which was presented in the affidavit in Seaver and presented in the affidavit in Mr. Carroll's case, is that because of modern digital forensic investigation techniques, evidence of the presence of the contraband or actual recovery of the contraband after very long periods of time, and in fact, Detective Spivey in his affidavit informed the court that he personally had recovered images from as far back as 5 years. And I think that because of that information presented to the judge, which hasn't been challenged, and so which the judge can rely on, that if the judge is being told that investigators can find this stuff, you know, going back a very long period of years, either because it hasn't been deleted or because deleted doesn't mean deleted, or because, you know, because the motivation might cause these individuals not to delete it, or even if they do, and even if it is deleted and the images aren't found, evidence of the presence of the images can still be found. And because of that, evidence of the crime is found. And therefore, without something defeating those facts and those technical conclusions presented to the magistrate, which Mr. Carroll has not attempted to do, I think that even the warrant that you're positing would, in fact, present probable cause to search location connected to the receipt of child pornography.
10 years? 20 years?
I don't think that a bright-line rule can be made, in part because the forensic technology is always changing. The technology with regards to digital media is always changing. And I think a bright line rule from this court setting a specific number at which computer evidence becomes stale would, especially on a record like this where we haven't fully explored the technology, I think would not would not sensibly acknowledge the realities of digital recovery, which is that if the physical container for that digital information still exists, there's a significant chance that whatever you're looking for or evidence of its prior existence is going to be found on subsequent examination, regardless of the passage of time.
If the file has been deleted and is no longer readily accessible to the person who had it, is he still in possession of it?
I do not believe he is. I don't believe that's the prior findings of this court. And I think that while that might go to whether someone can be held legally responsible following a search for the knowing possession of those files, I think in terms of evidence of their evidence of their interest in or sexual interest in children, evidence of
but
their
you may be able
possession
to prove earlier possession, you may be able to prove earlier receipt, but eventually, I mean, when you didn't balk at 20 years, I frankly got concerned.
Your Honor, with all due respect, technology is always changing, and I don't think that there's any bright line that can be drawn. I do think, of course, that if the result of the search is that there isn't evidence of knowing possession of contraband, even if the contraband is found, that's going to be an issue for whether the defendant can be found guilty. But still, even within the confines of that hypothetical, officers have in fact found, because there was probable cause for them to find, evidence that the crime had taken place. But you do get into the issue that is talked about in the Leon side of things of the of the statute of limitations, except for the fact now in the state court case, you know, as the defendant, you know, skillfully avoids, the statute of limitations for the molest ends in 2030 upon the girl's 31st birthday. But following the passage of various statutes in, I believe, the 2000s, there is no statute of limitations in federal court for child pornography distribution, receipt, or possession. By law, there's no statute
of
limitations.
There's no statute for possession?
I'm pretty sure for possession, if the possession is alleged to be, because of the change of the law, there's a period of time within which, and I believe it's before 2003 or before 1998, that the statute of limitations was removed, but cases where the possession is alleged to be before the change of law, like there's a transitory period, but after, and because I didn't brief this, I'm slipping on whether it was the Adam Walsh Act or the Protect Act.
We can look it up.
But my understanding is the federal government has removed statute of limitations for child pornography cases. That being said, this was a state court child molest case, so the relevant statute of limitations was in 2030.
I hear no further questions, so
thank you very much.
Back to Ms. Barner. With a minute remaining.
I think the problem that this court is struggling with as far as creation of a bright line rule gets back to my question of whether the information in this case was refreshed. I struggle with the concept that simply stating that someone owns a computer, uses a computer in conjunction with their work, has thumb drives, could refresh information, because I do all those things in relation to my work. I don't see, and I think that's a problem if we say 30 years ago there was evidence that someone received child pornography, and that person now owns a computer and uses it in conjunction with their work, that refreshes the information to the point that probable cause could be supported.
Well, there was a little more here, though. There was sort of what one could infer would be a protective carrying back and forth of that camera and those other digital media.
Well, in the affidavit,
he did daily.
It says that he was a professional photographer at the time, that she knew him to be a professional photographer. But that's it. And then it says, currently, he uses a computer in conjunction with his work, and that he carries this camera back and forth and uses thumb drives. We don't know what the state was at the time of the actual crime. And like I say, I think any of us would own a computer, a thumb drive, and a camera, and use a computer in conjunction with our work. As far as this court's finding in Prideaux-Wentz, I think that there are very significant differences between this case and that Prideaux-Wentz was actually a much stronger case. If the court has no further questions,
I have a question. You say Prideaux-Wentz was a much stronger case, but the issuing judge in this case had information that Detective Spivey had previously recovered images utilized for sexual gratification up to 5 years after the image was created. That, and the magistrate judge or the issuing judge in Prideaux-Wens did not have that information. Don't you think that that makes this case stronger than Prideaux-Wens?
I don't. Just because we as we've pointed out several times, the information in the affidavit was boilerplate language. The only information that we have that was actually addressing Mr. Carroll was two paragraphs only addressed the facts and circumstances at the time of the offense.
Well, so you're saying that his expertise about what collectors do is just boilerplate?
I'm saying that there's a boilerplate language component to this particular language. It doesn't relate particularly to Mr. Carroll until we get to those final paragraphs that are on the last page of the affidavit. And I think that's a problem. And I think in Prideaux-Wens, this court was specifically pointed out that the affidavit in that case was 40 pages and 66 paragraphs long, detailing an extensive investigation into that user. And we just don't have that for Mr. Carroll. If the court has no further questions for me, we would ask that this court reverse the district court's ruling on the motion to suppress and remand.
All right. Thank you again to both counsel. And that case will be taken under advisement with the others. And we will be in recess until the next sitting of the court.